Welcome to another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show, coming to you from San Francisco. This program is supported by listeners. My thanks today to Judy Holloway of Austin, Texas. A supporter of the PBC show. You can help too. Log on to my website at peterbcollins.com. It's right there on the homepage. And you can now subscribe for as little as $5 a month. I appreciate your support. It's what keeps us going. You're about to hear the sixth installment in the Boiling Frogs series of interviews, co-hosted by Sibel Edmonds. Sibel's been making a lot of news lately, and I hope you've been keeping tabs. Bradblog.com is a great resource. Corporate media blackout continues on her serious allegations that U.S. officials have been compromised by the nation of Turkey and its representatives. Today, you'll hear Peter Lance, a former ABC television correspondent, investigative reporter, and his book Triple Cross is the one Patrick Fitzgerald tried to block publication of. Yeah, you know Patrick Fitzgerald, the hero in the Scooter Libby case? That's what the corporate media wants you to believe. But Patrick Fitzgerald knew about Ali Muhammad. And Ali Muhammad, as you're about to hear, was a guy who penetrated the U.S. military and spy circles in an amazing way. Patrick Fitzgerald knew what a threat Ali Muhammad posed and failed to do anything about it. It's quite a story. And that's today's podcast here on the Peter B. Collins Show. Thanks for listening. Welcome to Boiling Frogs.
Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor, the rich get rich. That's how it goes.
Everybody knows, but do they? NSA's illegal domestic wiretapping, FBI's national security letters, state secrets privilege, TSA's 1 million-plus no-fly list, persecution of government whistleblowers, perpetual wars, rendition and torture. Can you feel the water boiling? Welcome to the Boiling Frogs.
It's the Boiling Frogs. I'm Peter B. Collins with Sibel Edmonds. And today, our guest is Peter Lance, former ABC television journalist. He's been an investigative reporter. He's written novels and screenplays. And he's going to talk with us today about his book, Triple Cross, which is part of a series of books about our national security issues and, in particular, terrorist attacks on our country. Peter Lance, welcome to the Boiling Frogs.
Great to be with both of you.
It's good to talk with you again. And I want people to know about your website, which they named after you, peterlance.com, because much of the information that we're going to talk about today is rich in detail. And you can get a lot of supporting information, excerpts from the books that Peter Lance has written and also recent articles that he has published. And there is also a link to the two-hour video from C-SPAN's Book TV program, which presents a PowerPoint, detailed PowerPoint presentation by Peter Lance on an issue that we're about to discuss. Primarily, Peter, we want to focus on your investigation into the characters who populated 9/11, and in particular, a guy named Ali Muhammad, who many Americans are not familiar with, and he plays a central role in the investigations into 9/11. But we want to begin with a story that you and I touched on when I last talked to you about a month ago, and that is that Patrick Fitzgerald, who is celebrated as a great prosecutor in this country, has a rather checkered history, and you reported on it in the book Triple Cross. And Fitzgerald was offended and unhappy with what you wrote about him, and so he has spent a lot of time threatening you and even using his official stationery as the U.S. attorney in Chicago to send you communications, and those seem out of bounds. And recently, Pat Fitzgerald received a bit of a plum from the Obama administration. He's been named as the interim chair of the Committee of U.S. Attorneys, and until the permanent chair is seated, he'll be in that post. But what is the latest in his struggle with you? He tried to get HarperCollins, your publisher, to stop the publication of the paperback edition of Triple Cross.
Right. I wanted to make one clarification. He, Patrick Fitzgerald began sending threat letters to HarperCollins in October of 07 as we were about to put the paperback edition of the book out. The book came out in hardcover in November of 06. And there are three areas that I'd like to get into in our discussion today, three serious kind of revelations that I report on in the book that have to do with his performance as co-head and later head of the Organized Crime and Terrorism Unit in the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District. This was what was called the Bin Laden Office of Origin. And Patrick Fitzgerald was the effective general of the War on Terror up until 9/11, because it was, as you know, Val and Peter, was fought as a series of legal cases investigated by the New York office of the FBI, which is where the original Joint Terrorism Task Force is, and prosecuted by what's known as the SDNY, the office that begat Rudy Giuliani, Louis Free, etc. So
let's not forget Judge Mukasey.
Judge Mukasey, exactly. Also Charlie Rangel, which I was kind of shocked to find out. He was an assistant U.S. attorney there. Anyway, so I just want to make one point of clarification. Fitzgerald literally trying to use the civil libel laws. And remember, he's a U.S. official, and under the defamation standard that we all live by, which is the New York Times versus Sullivan case, for a public official to successfully litigate a libel or defamation action, he has to prove that the information was false in the book or article, and he also has to prove reckless disregard for the truth, which is defined as actual malice. He has to basically be able to prove that Peter Lance knew something was false and went ahead anyway maliciously and published it.
Mm-hmm.
And the original book was 604 pages. You both have held it in your hand. It's 3 pounds. You could use it to press your shirts. It's so heavy. It had 1,420 endnotes. It had 32 pages of documentary appendices. Some pages have 10 separate annotations on the page. Recently, Forbes.com, a piece by Malik Kalin, called it meticulously researched. So anyway, he never could have propagated a litigated properly a libel claim. He knew that, but he sent the first letter, which is 9 pages, to HarperCollins on October 11th. They rejected him. Now, to get to your point, the second letter he sent, November 16th, he faxed from Office of U.S. Attorney. Wasn't on the stationery, but it might as well have been, because he wanted to send a clear message of who we were dealing with. So out of an abundance of caution, and given that this was Patrick Fitzgerald versus John Smith, we went back and we re-vetted Peter and Sabell, the entire book, and this every single fact, not just the information on Fitzgerald. This was incredibly debilitating to me. It took me off this ongoing investigation, took me out of play for 14 months.
Wow.
Literally, I have a fourth book that's over a year overdue for HarperCollins, but thank them, I have to say, they stood behind me 100%. The book came out on June 16th, but 2 weeks earlier, on June 2nd, and by the way, his third letter in September of 08, he used the word demand twice in the same sentence. He was almost like a kid stamping his foot. I demand that you cease publication. The last letter came June 2nd, and he said, quote, first of all, he called the entire book, quote, a deliberate lie masquerading as the truth, and it's the entire book. And then he said, if this book is published and it defames me or holds me in a false light, I will sue. Now, that was June 16th. How many weeks have gone by? And on the four-week anniversary, I wrote a Huffington Post piece, said, you know, put up or shut up, Mr. Fitzgerald. In other words, if you have a libel claim, file it or apologize. You've put this cloud over my head. You've attacked my credibility as a journalist. You've literally held this book up. And how dare a sitting U.S. official who takes an oath to uphold the Constitution try and use the civil libel laws to crush or kill a book? I mean, there is this thing called the First Amendment that we will talk about during the program. So anyway, that brings us up to date. We haven't heard a peep out of him, except I did file a complaint against him with the Justice Department on the 15th of June, the Office of Professional Responsibility, which is kind of the internal affairs unit at Justice. And any citizen has the right to do that. I filed a complaint with Mary Patrice Brown. I copied Eric Holder, the Attorney General, on the complaint, and I also copied Fitzgerald at his post office box in Chicago. And one of the counts in the book, in the complaint, is the fact that he lied to the Associated Press. He actually made a misstatement to the Associated Press in a national article on June 8th. He said to, he told an AP reporter, basically, Peter Lance in Triple Cross blames me for the deaths in the African embassy bombing and 9/11. Now, that is patently false. I never even came close to saying that. And yet, as a man who should choose his words carefully, he's making this reckless statement and the one about the entire book being a deliberate lie. So we have yet to hear from Justice. I spoke to a secretary in Ms. Brown's office about 2 weeks ago who said, well, we have your package, but it's going to take 8 to 12 weeks for us to get back to you. I've appealed to a member of Congress who's on the Judiciary Committee to monitor the case. I'm still waiting to hear back. And we'll see what happens. But the fact that he got a promotion by Eric Holder, who's clearly aware of this controversy since it broke in Newsweek and New York Magazine and the AP. The fact that the new attorney general would promote Patrick Fitzgerald or reward him, even with a temporary position, is indicative of the fact that they're not taking this seriously.
Well, and maybe Eric Holder reads Playboy, because you wrote a very powerful piece that summarizes this dispute, and that was
right.
Published in the June edition. I don't know who the centerfold was, but I have read the article, Peter, and I think you did a great job there of summarizing the issues. Now, for the benefit of listeners who are coming to this for the first time, Peter, tick off for us in bullet points, if you will, the key allegations that you make about Patrick Fitzgerald in Triple Cross that earned his ire.
Okay. Well, again, I can't get into his mind, so I can't say what it exactly was that pushed his buttons, but I'll give you a quick overview. First of all, as you mentioned, this Triple Cross is the third book in an ongoing investigation I've done for HarperCollins that began with a book called 1,000 Years for Revenge. The central finding in that book, Peter and Sibel, was the fact that I proved, and I think by a civil standard, a preponderance of the evidence, I proved that Ramzi Youssef, the original World Trade Center bomber, was the true architect of the 9/11 plot, that it was set in motion in Manila in the fall of 94, that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, Youssef's uncle, merely carried out the plot that Youssef created and began to execute before he was arrested. And that's a very significant finding because the 9/11 Commission, which I covered in my second book called Cover-Up, the 9/11 Commission pushed forward the date for the origin of the plot to a time after Youssef was arrested in February of 95. They claim, for the origin of the plot, that it was Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in 96 who kind of pitched the idea to bin Laden. Now, that is patently untrue, and the 9/11 Commission's sole authority, Peter and Sibel, for making that key conclusion, because the origin of the plot is essential. If you don't know when the plot began, you can't hold U.S. officials accountable for failing to have stopped it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that plot date, which was moved from the date that all the information I testified before the commission, I gave them probative evidence from the Philippines National Police that it was in the fall of 94. They moved it forward, flushed all of my evidence, reduced it to an endnote, and used Khalid Sheikh Mohammed as the sole authority. And now we now know he'd been waterboarded at least 183 times. He'd been tortured.
Yeah.
He's completely unreliable. It's like asking David Berkowitz when he did the first Son of Sam murder. Recently, Robert Windrum of NBC News went back and looked at the 9/11 Commission report and concluded, astonishingly, that 25% of their supporting documentation was based on the word of high-value detainees who were tortured. In other words, completely unreliable.
And so, and even Governor Kaine and Congressman Hamilton have misgivings about that they've gone public with since the publication
right.
of their bestseller.
Exactly. So so in other words, the last official word on the biggest mass murder in American history, 9/11, which remains a cold case. That's how I opened Triple Cross. And remember, bin Laden has never been indicted for it, and Khalid Sheikh, because of the torture, will probably never be convicted in any traditional sense of the word. We you know, who knows what's going to happen with his status at Guantanamo, but the bottom line is that remains a cold case. And so the first part of my book deals with this Ramzi Youssef. The second book, Cover-Up, focused on this 9/11 commission. And one day I woke up and I kept saying to myself, because I've cited so many instances where the FBI's New York office made stunning lapses, I mean astonishing lapses, one of which I'll be very quickly will tell you. And 20 years ago, July 1989, when Bush's President Bush's father was in the White House. The FBI Special Operations Group, the best of the best surveillance team, followed a group of Middle Eastern men from El Farouk Mosque on Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn to a shooting range in Calvert and Long Island, half an hour above the Hamptons at the height of the summer season, over four weekends. Of the men photographed by the FBI Special Operations Group, three were later convicted in the World Trade Center bombing in 93. Two were convicted by Patrick Fitzgerald and Andy McCarthy in the, quote, Day of Terror plot in 94-5. And one of them was the killer of Rabbi Meir Kahane in 1990, who I contend that was the first Al-Qaeda blood spilled on American soil. So that is just one of dozens of lapses I documented about the FBI's New York office. And so I kept saying to myself after I wrote the second book, what is going on here? You know, you've got negligence, gross negligence, and now it appears there are aspects of this story that just strike me as maybe affirmative cover-up, okay? So, and some of that cover-up had to do with just embarrassment over their failures. We can understand that. Most institutions do that. They hate to admit failure, so they rewrite history. But one day I woke up and I said, Ali Mohammed, he's the key. And just as Youssef was the operations guy for Al-Qaeda, the guy who blew things up on the ground, Ali was the intelligence guy, and as Lieutenant Colonel Anthony Schaefer, who's a good friend of both Sabelle and I, will tell you, any great army to succeed needs the J-2, which is the intelligence directorate, and the J-3, operations. So Ali was the spy, and that's why I focused on him in the third book, and I'll get to, whenever you jump in here, I'll get to the three significant lapses of Fitzgerald that relate to Ali Mohammed.
Well, let's go there now, and then I want to really open up to the case of Ali Mohammed, because it's fascinating, has so many connections, and as you point out, the 9/11 Commission completely missed it or intentionally overlooked it.
Before you go there, Peter, I have just one quick question with the Fitzgerald angle, and that is, yes, we have had some coverage of this Fitzgerald angle, but not nearly enough, Peter. And so much of it is because of this hero status that was granted to him during this Scooter Libby trial.
Libby.
And even that was done falsely, because so much of it was based on ignorance. They had no idea, people who were self-declared reporters, of the deals that Fitzgerald was making on this Scooter Libby case behind the scenes. Now, I had my contacts in the Justice Department, in the FBI, so I was getting firsthand information of what kind of not very good deals, not for the public, not for the truth, was being made, were being made by Fitzgerald behind the scene on this Scooter Libby case.
Wow.
But then the left, I don't know, it's like a hero complex. They needed this hero. They designated him as this hero. And you had this Betty and Jenny putting their self-declared journalistic hat going there reporting and make this guy like the white knight.
White knight.
Yeah, right. So because of that, a lot of these people, even though rationally they see the importance of this angle that you're exposing with Fitzgerald, they're refusing to cover because for them or to them it will be eating crows. And again, I'm talking about a lot of it being based on ignorance. Tell us a little bit what kind of reception you're getting from these ignorant people out there who call themselves journalists.
Well, that's a brilliant, brilliant question, Sabelle, because first of all, on every book that I've done, I've been on CNN multiple times. I've been on MSNBC multiple times. I've had a lot of, national television exposure for my work. This time around, I got nothing except Fox and Friends. It was just a favor that Brian Kilmeade did, and I was on Fox and Friends for like 5 minutes when I was in New York. But I could not get arrested. Keith Olbermann, Rachel Maddow, the liberals, and I look, I'm a liberal. I always have been a liberal. I voted for Obama. I campaigned for Obama. So I'm not knocking liberals per se, but what you describe is very, very significant, because there's as much of a problem with the media. In fact, maybe it's a bigger problem, being unwilling to admit fault and correct the wrong, as there is in the government. And one of the central themes in my work is how the FBI and Justice repeatedly fail to acknowledge fault and fail to then correct the pathology. We know from just basic medicine, the only way you can get a sick person well is to go in and define and diagnose the true pathology. What is the person sick? What's causing their illness? And then you correct it and they get better. If you just put cosmetics on the outside of the person, it never ends. And the journalistic community, and many of these are great people. They're wonderful people. Once they've decided on something, once they've declared somebody like Fitzgerald a white knight, they are extremely reluctant to go back and revisit that issue. And because it's more complicated, right? It's not a
exactly.
He's a good guy versus he's a bad guy. And what's really amazing, and I want you to jump in here, what's really amazing is that people don't, they didn't understand that he settled for a second-tier official, Scooter Libby, and the only person to go to jail was a New York Times reporter. And even though a lot of liberals didn't like Judy Miller because of her reporting leading up to Iraq, she still was a journalist, and no journalist deserves to do time because of their reporting. Do you know what I mean? So the journalistic community should have rallied around her. They didn't in general. Time magazine utterly folded, just utterly folded, you know, and the New York Times in particular wouldn't touch this Fitzgerald scandal. At least Michael Isikoff of Newsweek had the guts to break it. Boris Kochka broke it in New York Magazine. The New York Times, I went to Eric Lichtblau in the Washington Bureau. He started looking into it. He was very excited. Then he stopped. Then they threw it over to Metro and Motoko Rich, who covers publishing. And she goes, there's nothing new here. Then I appealed directly to Bill Keller, the executive editor. Didn't get a word out of him. Then Eric says, well, why don't you do an op-ed page piece? I appealed to the op-ed editor. No, not interested. The New York Times is still intimidated by Patrick Fitzgerald, in my opinion,
right,
and that
Peter,
is a truly terrifying thing.
Mainstream media, which is not even surprising, but what I'm mainly referring to is the mainstream media aside is the alternative media, even the blogosphere, these people who consider themselves objective and progressive and et cetera.
Right.
And to me,
right.
That part is really shocking, that you can't even sit down and engage in any kind of rational discussion with these people because mm-hmm. they have made up their mind, and once they have done it, they have basically fed that to the people. So you have all these people who have bought into this story put forth by the alternative media and the blogosphere.
Right, and I think you are a good example of once, you know, you've been really fearless. You're one of the most fearless people I've ever met in my life, and anyone that's ever met you, you're a very beautiful, diminutive woman, but you're fearless, okay? And you have, not only did you set up the National Intelligence Whistleblowers Coalition, but you've continued to fight for the truth. And what happens is you get, once you step too far across the mainstream line, you just put on the don't call list, the don't book 'em list, you know what I mean? And
mm-hmm.
the mainstream media doesn't really, it's like an on-off switch. It's not a rheostat. The Peter B. Collins of the world are very, very rare.
Absolutely.
Because Peter can interpret, he can go in and really look at something and analyze it in a very sophisticated way. Most of these people who use Matt Drudge, the assignment editors of the world who wake up every morning and decide what is news, they use Matt Drudge as their homepage, 90% of them, you know? And if it's not on Drudge, who's to the right of Genghis Khan, it's not a story.
Right on.
Well, thank you for the kind words. And, Peter, I just want to say that what you just described in your efforts to get coverage and comparing it to previous releases of your mm-hmm. work is strikingly mm-hmm. similar to the complaints of Vincent Bugliosi. And he had the book that was shocking to a lot of people. It mm-hmm. described trying George W. Bush for murder.
Right, right.
And he recounted to me how his previous books, many of them were very controversial, but he was always invited on the Today Show and Good Morning America, and almost every major outlet would mm-hmm. feature him in some way or another, primarily because he was a bestseller. And
right.
here, when he touched that third rail of accountability
right.
for Bush and Cheney, using,
right.
To be fair, a novel legal approach,
right.
he was just completely shut out. And I remember seeing him last summer at the convention in Denver, where mm-hmm. he showed up with a publicist in tow. Mm-hmm. Honestly, it appeared a little desperate. But he was thinking, well, where can I find a sympathetic journalist? Here they are at the
right.
coronation of Barack Obama, and there
right,
isn't
right.
much news, and maybe somebody will give me 5 minutes. But he was
right.
generally shut out once again.
You know, one thing that I think could be, I don't have anything to base this on other than just the raw just experience of what I've been through in the last, since I started working on these books and right after 9/11, and I'd love Sabell's opinion about this. But I think that there is a there's just this how do I say it I don't know it's there seemed to be a new set of rules. I mean, I was a correspondent at ABC News in the mid to late 80s, and I had my own unit on World News Tonight. I did stories for 2020 Nightline. I was a mainstream journalist, okay? And I encountered flack from time to time, but I was able to do stories on Pentagon cost overruns and the Pershing missile that didn't work, and I mean how the FAA was cooking the books on near mid-air collisions. And there was a kind of a freeze that happened at the end of my tenure around 1987 after Dateline NBC did the exploding truck story where they happened to be wrong, and all of a sudden the 60 Minutes to a lesser extent, but the certainly 2020 and Dateline began just focusing on like true crime. You know, the easy subjects, you know what I mean? True crime is like shooting fish in a barrel. It doesn't go after any corporation, any government official. It doesn't really make that much of a difference. It's anecdotal on the given criminal story that they tell, but it's very explosive in terms of, you know, it's titillating. And that was the beginning of a trend. And, of course, the 8 years of Bush, you saw, you know, I mean, a complete dial back on any enterprise reporting.
Right, and
what
you're
really
and
worries
the
me
Peter,
about Obama,
Peter,
here's what worries me.
The role that that you used to play is now performed by John Stossel, who has has a very clear conservative agenda in his and I'm using air quotes here, in his reporting.
Right, exactly. Or ironically, the gutsiest reporting on television is being done by Jon Stewart.
Yeah.
I mean, look what he finally did on CNBC and that whole meltdown. But here's the terrifying thought that I have about Obama, and that is that, you know, nobody is president until they become president, I guess, unless you're part of it, like the Bush dynasty, right? But so you become president. You give all multiple years of Barack's life were devoted to getting this prize, this unprecedented thing. And he gets there, and then he realizes he's got a government to run. And there are so many people like Pat Fitzgerald in the government that are the principal functionaries that make the government run day to day. He's served four presidents now, right? Fitzgerald is a real, he's like a bedrock part of the Justice Department on Pennsylvania Avenue, you know? And so you get in and you say, you know, I want to go after these guys in the CIA for waterboarding, you know? And then the new CIA director takes over, your man, and he starts talking to the brass at the CIA, and they go, if he does this, we're laying down on the job. We're not going to do anything, man. You're going to see guys being, like, retiring early. And so the president begins to get worried. Am I going to be able to be effective as a leader? And they intimidate. Now, can I prove this? Am I in the room with these guys? No. I'm just talking about my sense as a seasoned investigative reporter who's been doing this for 30 years now, okay? My sense of how things operate, because I can't explain Barack Obama's dial back on the accountability for waterboarding. I can't explain his position. I hope Sabella jumps in on the state secret privilege. I can't explain why they would actually file a brief defending Dick Cheney's right to privacy, for God's sake.
Yeah.
Are you kidding me? I mean, so the only conclusion, because I don't believe Barack is a bad man. I think he's a really good man. I was inspired by him, and I think he intends to help this country. But the only explanation I can have is that this second and third tier bureaucracy that makes the government run day to day has such power that, you know, that presidents get intimidated, even the ones with the best intentions. I'd love Sabella's reaction to this.
No, I completely agree with you, 100%. And you covered it all, Peter.
Yeah.
So let's come back to Patrick Fitzgerald and the three key things that he missed in the investigations that preceded 9/11.
Okay, well, first of all, let's talk in broad terms about Patrick Fitzgerald, the line that he uses, which is the Justice Department, the Southern District's line, and it's the line that ultimately was in the 9/11 Commission report, okay? Believe it or not, despite overwhelming evidence that al-Qaeda had an effective base in New York in 1988, shortly after the formation of al-Qaeda, where Dr. Ayman al-Zawahiri merged the Egyptian Islamic Jihad with bin Laden and effectively created al-Qaeda by taking over what was known as the MAK, the Office of Services for the Mujahideen, this worldwide fundraising network, which had its New York principal office at this Al-Farouq Mosque in Brooklyn. Despite overwhelming evidence of an al-Qaeda presence in New York, Patrick Fitzgerald in an interview in 2005 for a documentary that was done for the National Geographic Channel, which I got the transcript, was actually asked, well, you know, of course Al-Qaeda was involved in the first Trade Center attack. And he goes, no, you know, I'm not really kind of willing to say that now that Al-Qaeda was involved in that. Well, you know, it was, and the 9/11 Commission, what they said was a loosely organized group of Sunni Islamists did the first Trade Center bombing. And nobody wants to connect the dots between Ramzi Youssef's first attack and the ultimate attack of 9/11, even though Youssef's uncle did it. So there's this extraordinary mythology that has grown up that Patrick Fitzgerald is one of the leading proponents of, that basically what it does is it takes Youssef out of the 9/11 plot. And the reason I believe they've done that is that I prove in my first book, 1,000 Years, and I have even more proof in Triple Cross, that Ramzi Youssef, that they could have stopped the World Trade Center bombing. They, the feds, the FBI, had multiple opportunities as a result of this incredible undercover asset named Ahmad Salam, who infiltrated the Blind Sheikh cell, only to be pushed out, I mean, risking his life for $500 a week, pushed out by a guy named Carson Dunbar, an ex, you know, Jersey State trooper who was given the terrorism unit, who had no experience, didn't like Nancy Floyd, the heroic agent who recruited Salem, didn't like Salem, and basically caused Salem to leave. Well, after the day after the attack, they brought Salem back and they paid him $1.5 million to do what he could have done in the fall of 92. And in 3 months, he wrapped up the Blind Sheikh and the entire cell in what the plot that helped make Patrick Fitzgerald's career called the Day of Terror plot. That was a completely, that was what I call the mop-up case by the feds for failing to stop the first Trade Center attack. So Ramzi Youssef, who's the, if you believe in the great person theory of history, and he is the Mozart of terror. I mean, this guy is a criminal genius who went from building 1,500-pound bombs to be moved by truck to a site to these tiny little bomb triggers to blow up planes using the fuel tank. That guy created the planes as missiles plot. And if he had been locked up in 1992 in the fall when they had an opportunity, which I prove they did, it never would have been 9/11. Trust me. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So Fitzgerald is one of the proponents of that. So let's go to the first of three stunning, jaw-dropping, I think, revelations in Triple Cross. This relates directly to 9/11. First of all, I'm going to give you three dots on a chart. Dot number one is the fact that El Sayed Nosair, the Egyptian who killed Rabbi Kahane, who was trained by Ali Muhammad, who was photographed by the FBI in Calvert in Long Island in 1989, July, as I said earlier, he had a mailbox at a place called Sphinx Trading in Jersey City on Kennedy Boulevard.
Mm-hmm.
And the way I found this was because I had the transcripts of all the 40,000 pages of the federal cases, but because Nosair was tried as a lone gunman by the Manhattan District Attorney, I never had the transcript. I finally cobbled it together, and my jaw dropped when I saw the fact that this guy had this mailbox. And I went, Kennedy Boulevard, doesn't the Blind Sheikh have a mosque there? Sure enough, I go to Kennedy Boulevard, and I see right below the Al-Salam Mosque in the same building as Sphinx Trading. It's still operating, okay?
Amazing.
So the first dot is that the killer of a world figure who is Al-Qaeda associated, trained by Al-Qaeda's master spy, Ali Muhammad, has a mailbox. Now, let's cut to, and this is where people who go to peterlance.com can download this timeline that I have in the book, and they can also, below that, download these appendices that I'm going to refer to, because in the book, there is on page, it's appendix 10, I think it's page 606, 607, there is a list of 172 unindicted co-conspirators. And that is a list that Patrick Fitzgerald and Andrew McCarthy put together for this Day of Terror case, the mop-up case, all right? And on the list of 172 unindicted co-conspirators, which Fitzgerald put together in 94, was Muhammad, first of all, Osama bin Laden is on it, Muhammad Jamal Khalifa, his brother-in-law, Ali Muhammad, and one, number 130 is Walid al-Noor. Well, when I found out about Sphinx, I did a certificate of incorporation search, and Walid al-Noor is a co-founder of Sphinx.
Hmm.
So that's the second dot, that Patrick Fitzgerald considers the co-founder of Sphinx Trading significant enough to put on a list with bin Laden in 1994, okay? Here's the third dot. Where do you think Al-Madar and Al-Hazmi, two of the hijackers who flew American 77 into the Pentagon, got their fake IDs and had mailboxes in the summer of 01?
Jersey City at the Sphinx Trading Company.
Yeah, exactly. So what I'm, what I, and they got the fake IDs from Mohammed Al-Atras, the partner who's on the certificate of incorporation with Waleed Al-Noor. Now, when Patrick Fitzgerald was lionized in Vanity Fair, and I know Vanity Fair has been good to Sibel, but they'd be even better to Patrick Fitzgerald because they did a piece called Mr. Fitz Goes to Washington, and there's even a joke website on how many times they described his intelligence. Scary smart, the Bin Laden brain, mainframe computer brain, supposed to have every factoid on Al-Qaeda in his head. To this day, right?
Mm-hmm.
Patrick Fitzgerald is co-head and later head of organized crime and terrorism, both. He wears two hats in the Southern District. What I've said, and I would say it to his face, and I hope I get a chance to debate him in person sometime. Patrick, if you had devoted 10% of the energy that you put into getting John Gotti, where you monitored the Ravenite Social Club in Little Italy around the clock for 7 years, you photographed every Sicilian American that came and went. After the Teflon Don beat you three times, you finally got him by putting a spike mic in the apartment of a mafia widow, and you got the Gotti, which is great, right? If you had put 10% of that energy in monitoring Sphinx Trading, which you described in the Day of Terror cases, the Jersey Jihad office, you described, the Al-Salam Mosque upstairs as a hotbed of Islamic activity in convicting the blind sheikh, why wouldn't you monitor this place? And if you had, you would have been in the middle of the 9/11 plot in July of 01. And you add that to Condi Rice and the chatter that was going on, George Tenet, that my hair's on fire, you know, all the stuff that was happening, Richard Clark, people running around, the Phoenix memo, July 10th. You imagine they get the Phoenix memo saying monitor flight schools July 10th, and then they find out that these guys who got in, and were highly visible, by the way, in San Diego, Almodar and Al-Hazmi's brother, were highly visible. Why couldn't they have connected those dots? And again, they would have had another opportunity. So that's one of my revelations that I think Patrick might have been a little upset with.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. Well, let's move now to the focus on Ali Muhammad, because
right. In
all the things that you just described, he really is a key player. And our government was duped by him on multiple occasions in multiple locations, including here in Silicon Valley near me.
Exactly. Ali Muhammad was, their principal spy. And he was an ex-Egyptian army officer. He was a commando. He was a major in the Egyptian army. It was his unit that murdered Anwar Sadat in 1981, which is why my timeline at peterlance.com begins with the Sadat murder. And Ali Muhammad escaped prosecution at the time because, ironically, he was on an officer exchange program in the United States. Now, after Mubarak took over as president of Egypt, he purged the Egyptian military, supposedly, of radical elements, and Ali was kicked out of the Egyptian army. Dr. Ayman al-Zawahiri, who, as I said, went on to become the number two guy, comes from one of the most prominent families in Egypt. One of his grandfathers was president of Al-Hazar University, the oldest university in the Arab world. Another one was the U.S. ambassador, the Egyptian ambassador to Saudi Arabia. There's a street named after the al-Zawahiris. He's a surgeon, a very wealthy family. He became the spokesman for all those arrested after the Sadat murder, and he became famous, and he kind of dominated the Islamic Egyptian Jihad, which he, as I said, merged with Al-Qaeda. So he decided early on, we need a spy. We need a guy that we can send in to, because I guess he had long-range plans to go after America. So he recruits Ali Muhammad, sends him to Egypt Air. So Ali spends his first year after getting kicked out of the army at Egypt Air, where he learns all the anti-terrorism countermeasures, okay? Then he approaches the CIA in 84. After, if you remember, in the spring of 83, in Beirut, there was the bombing of the embassy that looked like the Oklahoma City bombing. It pancaked. Right. There were many people killed. And then, of course, you had the tragic Marine Barracks bombing in October of 83 with the French garrison the same day. And the CIA was desperate for Islamic-speaking people, right? So Ali approached the CIA station in Cairo, and they put his name out in the domain as this FBI agent Clunan related the story to me. He was part of Fitzgerald's I-49 squad. And Hamburg snaps. So Hamburg CIA station wants Ali to go into a mosque. He goes into the mosque, supposedly blows his cover, okay? But he ends up on a watch list. But somehow he gets past the watch list. He gets on a TWA flight into America. We're on the flight in from Athens. to JFK, he seduces an American woman named Linda Sanchez. And this is this guy's first true conquest as a spy. He wins this woman's heart. And I have the only interview with her ever given. It's in Triple Cross. And it's astonishing because she still loves the guy, even though she knows what a monster he was. And now he's living in Silicon Valley in Santa Clara in her house, where he sets up a sleeper cell. And he gets another young Egyptian named Dahab to kind of run the sleeper cell with him. And he then enlists Peter and Sabelle in the U.S. Army, but he goes under the radar. He knows if he goes into OCS school, he's going to be subject to greater scrutiny. So he goes in as an enlisted man. And where does he end up? At the John F. Kennedy Special Warfare School at Fort Bragg with the elite Green Beret officers trained. Now, his commanding officer, Anderson, said to me it would be easier to win the Powerball lottery than to have been in the unit that killed Sadat and ended up there. So he was always suspicious that either the CIA or the FBI helped Ali get there for whatever reasons, maybe payback for the Mujahideen's help against the Soviets, who knows. But Ali, on weekends now, in 89, is coming to New York, where he trains that cell that I told you that was photographed at Calverton. He then, listen to this, I find out he becomes an FBI informant on the West Coast from 1992 on. And at one point, the system works. The Royal Canadian Mounted Police grab him in 1993, and because he's trying to smuggle an Al-Qaeda terrorist named Marzouk in from Vancouver, and they put him in a room, they interrogate him. At the end of the day, he writes the number. He says, call it. John Zent. He's my FBI control agent. John Zent vouches for Ali Mohammed. Now, John Zent is an empty suit of epic dimensions, which I describe in detail in Triple Cross. The worst possible guy to be, quote, controlling a guy like Ali Mohammed. But what does Ali do when he gets out? He goes to Nairobi, where he takes the first surveillance pictures of the U.S. Embassy for the plot that he was a principal co-conspirator in to blow up the embassy in Nairobi in Tanzania 5 years later. And even Bin Laden pointed to the pictures in 94 and says, that's where I want the bombs to go. Not only did he plan that plot, he moved Bin Laden's entire entourage from Afghanistan to Khartoum. Ali Mohammed set up all the Al-Qaeda training camps in Sudan. He wrote the manual on terror that they found in Manchester, England, and he trained Bin Laden's personal bodyguard. And he's an FBI informant from 92. And Andrew McCarthy, the co-prosecutor of the Day of Terror case, remember I told you about him with the list of unindicted co-conspirators?
Right.
He, in 94, a defense attorney subpoenas Ali Mohammed. They want him to testify at this trial because they want to peel back the layers and expose his relationship to the U.S. military. That's going to be their defense, okay? And Andy McCarthy literally flies to California, meets Ali, who flies back from Africa, and Ali shines him on and says, I'm running a scuba diving business in Kenya. And this hardened federal prosecutor, partner of Fitzgerald in the case, apparently believes him, even though he put his name on a list with Bin Laden and effectively lets him go. That's 94. But now, cut to 97, and here's where Fitzgerald comes in. 1997, the Southern District Squad I-49, this Bin Laden squad, is investigating, and they know that there's something going on in Africa. So Dan Coleman, an agent from the squad, goes to Nairobi and searches the home of Wadi El-Hajj. And Wadi El-Hajj is a Lebanese convert from Christianity to Islam. He's one of the central players in this whole thing that takes it right back to the Brooklyn Mosque. He happened to be in Brooklyn the day the former So the head of the mosque was murdered in New York. He visited El Sayed Nasser at Rikers Island, the guy who killed Kahane. He's a stone Al-Qaeda operator. He was Bin Laden's major domo in the Sudan, okay, this Wadi El-Hajj. So now he's working with Ali to perfect this embassy bombing plot. And Coleman, an FBI agent, searches his house and finds, shockingly, evidence of Ali Mohammed's link to him. An FBI informant, right? So they fly Patrick Fitzgerald, an agent named Harlan Bell, and another one named Jack Quinn, and fly to Sacramento, where Ali is now living. And they meet him in a restaurant across from the State House. And this is verbatim from Jack Clunan, who was there, who was a principal source to my book. Fitzgerald naively thinks he can turn Ali Mohammed at this point in 1997, the fall of. And Ali says to him, I love Bin Laden. I don't need a fatwa to attack America. I have a bunch of sleepers I can make operational at any time. And he thumbs his nose at Fitzgerald and gets up and leaves. Fitzgerald turns to Clunan and says, that is the most dangerous man I've ever met. We cannot leave him on the street. And yet, Sabelle and Peter, he left him on the street for 10 more months, only to have the bombs go off in Africa. He then waits a month before he arrests Ali, puts him under a John Doe warrant in the MCC, Federal Jail in Lower Manhattan, I believe, so that the press would not know he was there, and cuts a deal ultimately with Ali Muhammad. Now, what do you get when you cut a deal? Like Sammy the Bull Gravano killed 19 people, he got 5 years, but he became the star witness for the feds and all the mafia trials. That's what you do in a deal. You get, in return for a lighter sentence or no death, you get something, you give something to the feds.
You guess sing, you must sing for your supper.
Yeah, you sing for your supper. So, but when Patrick Fitzgerald commences U.S. versus Bin Laden, the African embassy bombing trial in February of 01, arguably the most important case in recent Justice Department history, because it's the indictment of the man who's probably more dangerous to U.S. security interests than anyone since Adolf Hitler, okay, Osama bin Laden. And does he call Ali Muhammad as a star witness? No. He never takes the stand. Instead, they use another guy named Jamal El-Fadl. They wait 10 months until the bombs go off in Africa, doesn't take him off the street, and then cuts a deal with him to basically buys his silence. He doesn't use him, U.S. versus bin Laden, the African embassy bombing trial in February of 01, arguably the most important trial in recent Justice Department history. And he buys his silence. He's now, Ali Muhammad is in some kind of custodial witness protection somewhere. And there are seals upon seals on his case. And until I wrote Triple Cross, there had been articles about him over the years, but no one ever connected the dots on Ali or Fitzgerald's negligence with respect to Ali. I would love Sibel Edmonds to join me and others to try and get a joint committee of the House Intelligence Committee to bring Ali Muhammad out of hiding in open session and have him tell the truth about what happened, how he snookered Patrick Fitzgerald and these people in the Justice Department over the years. He's a one-man 9/11 commission. And if he could ever be...
Before we move further, I really want to cover this session. I don't know if you were present during the 9/11 commission session on Ali Muhammad. Were you there?
Hold on just a second, Sibel. I'm getting a little feedback. I just need to turn you down and then bring you back. Okay, go ahead.
Hello? I'm sorry. Go ahead, Sibel.
Were you present during the 9/11 Commission's session on Ali Muhammad, the hearing?
I wasn't present during the hearing, but I saw the transcript. You mean when Fitzgerald testified and he described him briefly?
And the FBI, they had people from the Justice Department. I was there, and I went there specifically because it was supposed to be on Ali Muhammad, okay?
Right.
So they gave these handouts of the questions and the areas that they were going to talk about and ask questions about, et cetera, on Ali Muhammad. Mm-hmm. Now, in the information section for background for Ali Muhammad, and this is 9/11 Commission's handout,
before
the hearing started, okay, it listed the fact that, yes, he penetrated the army, but then there was a paragraph that said he tried to obtain a job as a translator, language specialist for Arabic, with the FBI.
Right.
And the FBI received his application, but they realized that his background was not as clean and he was not hired. Therefore, he went and started working as a security manager for a private company.
Right.
Did you see this?
I know all that, but they never admitted that he was an FBI informant from 1992 on.
Correct. So what was the deal? Because 9/11 Commission, they knew about it.
Of course.
Okay.
Absolutely knew about it. In fact, in what's called the Dan Coleman memo, Dan Coleman, the guy who found the evidence in Africa with Wadi al-Hajj, he wrote a famous memo or affirmation that describes Ali Muhammad in great detail, and he talks about his status, his interaction with the Bureau in California. He doesn't mention John Zent by name, but he actually talks about how in the early 90s, Ali told his FBI people in California that Al-Qaeda was seeking to overthrow the government in Saudi Arabia. He identified bin Laden to them in the early 90s.
Right.
I mean, clearly the 9/11 Commission just scratched the surface.
Well, not only that was misinformation in that handout,
right.
Okay?
Right,
It did not at all give information about the fact that, yes, he was on the payroll as an informant.
Right.
It said, no, he applied for a position as a translator. Now, the hearing starts. And this is supposed to be mainly on Ali Muhammad. Within the first few minutes after the second question, they stop. There is some whispering. And they just gloss over that topic and they move to the next topic. And this was supposed to be their main topic for the day. with this handout that was 4 pages, with all the people there to answer questions. And something happened in the middle of this hearing.
Wow.
And they just ignored the handout, and they just moved to the next topic, even though the witnesses they brought it there, the FBI, the Justice Department, they were there for Ali Mohammed's case. So
you know,
Chabelle,
I wish I had known
there?
That. I would have put it in this edition. If I ever get another edition, I definitely want to get this. I hope I get a transcript of this program.
Yeah, Kristen Breitweiser there, Lori was there, I was there. We were sitting in the front row. And we, in fact, started writing questions on the paper. And because they had this liaison person, the family members, the activist family members, and we kept sending it to the commissioner saying, what happened? What happened?
Wow.
They just ignored the question. And that was when I came back home, and that's how you and I met, because I contacted you after that.
Exactly. No, that's right. Well, you know, one of the other things that happened is, and I don't know if it was the same day, it was when Patrick Fitzgerald testified. It was one of the last days of the commission hearings in June of 2004. The report actually came out in August. And he got up and he had a 2,800-word statement, and 280 words, 10% of his statement, were devoted to Ali Mohammed. Of all the things, of all of his experiences as head of organized crime and terrorism that he could have said in the years leading up to 9/11, of all his experience, he devoted 10% to a description of Ali Mohammed. But again, he told the superficial stuff, the stuff about how bad Ali was, didn't even hint at how the Justice Department and he in particular were outmaneuvered and snookered by Ali Mohammed all those years. So I'd be very interested in getting whatever you have on that hearing that day. And
family members have it. I know Kristen Breitweiser kept all the documentation, the handouts and everything.
Good. Great. Okay. Well, I hope to get in touch with her. I haven't spoken to her in a while, but anyway,
well, and let me.
I just mentioned briefly the third element involving Fitzgerald is all contained in that Playboy piece called The Chilling Effect that can be accessed at peterlance.com. We didn't get to the third rung of this little three-legged stool on Fitzgerald, but that material having to do with the suppression of key al-Qaeda evidence in New York in 96 is all detailed in The Chilling Effect. Playboy, or you know, peterlance.com. You can get it through there.
And Peter, just to broadly characterize the work of the 9/11 Commission, I went to Washington at my own expense to spend a couple of days there observing their work, and I was really floored because I was there for the public testimony of Condoleezza Rice, Colin Powell, and Donald Rumsfeld.
Right.
And I'll just briefly recap the Rumsfeld, because this is what truly stunned me. Richard Benveniste, who came closest to being aggressive as a member of the 9/11 Commission, and he had his own shortcomings, but he was pursuing a line of questioning with Rumsfeld about the events of the morning of 9/11, and he asked him point blank, at what time did you order jets scrambled to protect the Pentagon? And Rumsfeld, as if he were, you know, just kind of talking to people over drinks or something like that, he was very casual about it. He repeated the question. He said, did I order jets scrambled to defend the Pentagon on 9/11? And he kind of paused for a second, and then Judge Kane, or Governor Kane, came to his rescue. He gaveled and said, time's up. Next question. And they switched to Jim Thompson from Illinois, who wasn't a bad prosecutor, wasn't a bad governor, but was totally lame on the 9/11 Commission.
Sure.
And he changed the subject. And we never got an answer to a very obvious and critical question about the performance of the defense secretary on that day. And to me, that is an example. And one of the metaphors I use for the work of the 9/11 Commission is a construction device called the ditch witch. And when you want to dig a ditch to lay a sewer pipe or a water pipe, you set this thing, and if you want an 8-foot ditch, you set it for 8 feet.
Right.
And my metaphor is that the 9/11 Commission was a ditch witch, and it was set to dig a ditch about a foot deep, and the real information was at least 2 feet down. And by setting the machine that way, they made sure that they never really got into the heart of many critical issues. And, Peter, tell me your thoughts about the role of Philip Zelikow, who was sent from the White House. He had been an assistant to Condi Rice and had co-authored a book with her. and David Ray Griffin, who's written a very critical book of the 9/11 Commission. In fact, he took their report apart line by line. He calls it the Kane Zellico Commission. And his argument is that Phil Zellico was the guy who was there to make sure that they didn't stray into sensitive areas. What's your view?
Well, absolutely, I believe that. In fact, my book cover-up, from published in 04, a month after the commission's report was published, is the first book. The second half of it is a critical analysis of the commission. And it's the first book. I mean, Phil Sheehan finally came out with a book, I think, in 2008 called The Commission. God love him, for a former New York Times reporter who I very much respect. But my book was the first one to do it. And I had a source inside the commission. I used to, like a deep throat, I met the guy every Monday in New York. I spent that winter in New York, 2004. And this guy said to me, Peter, they're cherry-picking the evidence. They're only looking from, like, 1998 forward. They're never going to go back to Brooklyn in 1989 or Calvin or any of those issues. And Zellicow is running the show. And he wanted to resign, this guy. And I kept talking him into staying because he was my only source inside. And there's no doubt that Zellico is a crony of Condi Rice's. But the Democrats are equally culpable. And, you know, Richard Benvenista, how many people, think of who is on the Justice Department. Benvenista, former federal prosecutor. Jim Thompson, former federal prosecutor.
Yeah.
The Dietrich Snell, and this is, if you read Peter Lanz, if you go to peterlanz.com and go to my timeline, Dietrich Snell, who is senior counsel to the commission, who's the guy who took my testimony and buried it, he should have been a witness before the commission, because I prove that Dietrich Snell and Mike Garcia, the assistant U.S. attorneys under Fitzgerald, got the information from the Philippines military, Philippines National Police, from Colonel Boogie Mendoza. I literally traced it through Sam Carmelowitz, a brilliant DSS officer who took the information from Camp Crema, where Colonel Mendoza interrogated Abdul Hakim Murad, Youssef's oldest friend, who was a pilot trained in four flight schools, who was to be the lead pilot in the original configuration of the plot. I proved that there were seven targets: the Pentagon, the CIA headquarters in Langley, the White House, the Sears Tower, the Transamerica Tower, of course, the World Trade Center, and an unnamed nuclear facility. I proved that there were 10 Islamic pilots training in America at that time. And all of that information got to the Southern District, and it was completely ignored. So Dietrich Snell should have been a witness in front of the commission. Instead, what do? They make him senior counsel. And when I said the Jersey Girls brought my first book to the hearing, in the Washington hearing in the fall of 04, Governor, the only good guy in the commission, in my opinion at all, was the former senator from Alabama, from Georgia, blanking on it, was the war veteran. I'm blanking on it.
Anyway, Max Cleland.
Max Cleland. He started reading from my book after a lunch break. He got kind of bought off the commission. He was given some job, some banking positions, and he left. So the only decent guy they had was Max Cleland. He was gone. And Governor Kane finally read my book, supposedly over Christmas, and I got a letter in January saying, you will testify. Philip Zelikow will contact you. Zelikow sends me a letter saying, Dietrich Snell will contact you. I'm like, Dietrich Snell? You know, and so on the Ides of March of 04, I went into the 26 Federal Plaza where they had their office in New York. No stenographer present, no recording equipment, and Dietrich Snell basically flushed everything I had to say about the origin of the plot. So, yeah, I totally agree with you. It was a whitewash. Half the staff were from the very agencies they were supposed to be finding accountable. They decided early on they weren't going to find anybody accountable. And Jamie Gorelick is one of the most egregious members. She was the Deputy Attorney General under Clinton. And she, in my book, I go into great detail about how Muhammad Jamal Khalifa was captured in the fall of 94 in Morgan Hill, California, not far from your neck of the woods, Peter.
Right.
And I believe he was going to see Ali Muhammad. They caught him with a Newton PDA, with all kinds of information leaking him to the Manila cell of Youssef, the New York cell, and he had a death sentence in Jordan hanging over his head, right? What better reason to talk to the feds? And literally, Jamie Gorelick and Warren Christopher pushed on the behalf of Jordan to get him out of the country. And by the time he left, the death sentence had been eliminated because a witness recanted. So we lost the brother of law of Osama bin Laden, and a Democratic administration, namely Jamie Gorelick, was largely responsible. And she ends up on the 9/11 commission.
Yeah, that was amazing. And her work was truly lame. You could see it at the time.
Yeah.
She was pulling punches.
So,
she was not really...
We're all out here pushing for the truth, and few people do it with the skill and energy of Sibel Edmonds, and I'm honored to know you, and you came to my press conference, which I really appreciated when my book came out. You stood by me the day it was published, met my daughters, and, you know, all we can do is just thank God we have something in this country resembling some kind of freedom of the press, although it's diminishing day by day. And what you're doing is just fabulous, Sibel.
Now, Peter, let me take a moment here and ask you where we go from here, because I think we're in agreement that the 9/11 Commission was a farce, and Therefore the information that they have left creates the official myth of what occurred. And we know that it's glaringly incomplete, and that's being charitable. So where do you go when you see books like those by David Ray Griffin that raise serious questions about how the Twin Towers came down, about how Building 7 came down? How far do you go in challenging the official story and exploring alternate theories?
Well, I believe I'm not an inside job theorist. I don't believe that 9/11 was created. But I truly believe that the Bush administration in particular allowed some event to happen, that there was clear warning that some huge event was going to happen, and it was kind of allowed to happen, okay?
Now, do you consider that, do you consider that gross negligence or calculation?
Well, I think, you know, if you get hit by a car driven by a drunk driver or somebody kills you with a gun with intent to kill, you're dead in both instances, right? So in this case, at this point, what I'm saying in terms of answering your question about what we need a truth commission, not, as Patrick Leahy said, patted on the 9/11 commission. That would be a disaster. We need a truth commission made up of people like Sibel, journalists like you and me, members of victims' family members like the Jersey Girls, scholars like people like Peter Dale Scott up at Berkeley, people who are from the left and the right. It has to be truly like, I don't know, populated by people of all political persuasions, but none of whom have had any contact with the government, and there has to be subpoena power. And I fear that the only thing that's going to ever even remotely allow that to happen is another event, which I really feel we're vulnerable to have happen. I believe Al-Qaeda is as lethal as it's ever been, and with respect to my area of expertise, which is the FBI, there are only like 30 plus Arabic-speaking translators of 6,000 counterterrorism agents this long after 9/11. The trilogy, the virtual case file system that was going to get rid of the paper culture, where they're going to put everything on computer disks so they could do what I did with FileMaker Pro and Google and a Mac, that was hundreds of millions of dollars thrown out. They scrapped that. Now they have a thing called Sentinel that Lockheed Martin has designed, and they're saying 2010 before that's operational. So the Bureau has failed to reform, in my opinion, and I don't believe it ever will. I think that the Bureau is in the crime solution business, not the threat prevention business. They should give counterterrorism, if anything, if there's any existing agency, I think they should give it to the Secret Service, because the Secret Service is at least had actually a pretty good record over the years, despite some assassinations, but they did the Seattle Olympic, I mean the Salt Lake City Olympics, so they're capable of large scale threat prevention, work. I just think, and they're trusted, you know, and so that would be my vote. I would take it away from the FBI. Even Jack Clunan, this agent who I interviewed, who was one of the main guys to run the book on Ali Mohammed for Fitzgerald's unit, he said the same thing to me. So the FBI is the worst agent. Robert Wright has said that. Sibel knows a lot of these agents who are members of her group that have left, that have said the FBI is like the worst agency possible to try and protect America against counterterrorism. Against terrorism.
Peter, I want to go back to Ali Mohammed again, because in that handout, it said also that after he was refused by the FBI to be hired as a translator, right?
Yeah, right.
Then he went and worked as a security manager for this private firm.
Right.
Are you familiar with that?
Yeah, a defense contractor. In fact, Jack Clunan told me, and I have a lot of facts in my head, so I don't want to, I could be wrong on this, but I'm pretty sure it was a defense contractor who actually had responsibility for making the triggers for the Trident missile system.
Well, let me give you more details, because I was chasing that angle, and what I got was he was working as a security manager in one of the plants for Northrop Grumman.
Okay.
And Northrop Grumman started as an Israeli company. And for their security background check, when they hire international people, not only they do security background check with the database and everything here in the United States, but they also have this agreement that for their employees that they have security clearance for, they check background via the agency Mossad in Israel. So this guy worked for Northrop Grumman, and his background check was done both over there and over here. I mean, to me, that was another one of those.
That's a shocking revelation that I didn't know. And you're, wow, that's amazing, Sibel. Good for you that you found that. I need to talk to you more about that.
No, and I just got stuck there. My whole question was, and I kept digging or trying to dig, and I couldn't get any further. What was his job exactly? Which one of those plants were the plants that he worked, and how he obtained this clearance to be the security manager for that particular plant? And I never got any further than that.
I don't know if he was a security manager or a security guard. Are you sure he wasn't just a rent-a-cop?
I'm not sure. But
because
he got clearance.
Clinton seemed to imply that he was more like a rent-a-cop. But he did say to me, quote, Peter, he was inside the gate, if you know what I mean. And
right.
We now know, you know, there's another empty suit named Mike Sheehan. Mike Sheehan was the former head of counterterrorism for New York City, and he's a former Army, I think, lieutenant colonel who worked in the Clinton White House, and he's a major guy in the, quote, security game, Mike Sheehan. And I was at a dinner in 06 with him one night, and I mentioned Ali Muhammad. He went, oh, Ali Muhammad, he was just an E5. He was nothing down at Fort Bragg. He didn't have a security clearance. And the point is, it didn't matter. So Ali Muhammad, go to peterlance.com on the right-hand side under the timeline, hit where it says top secret, and you'll download a couple of top secret, formerly top secret memos from the Joint Chiefs of Staff and other things that he got. So it didn't matter that Ali Muhammad didn't have the security. He was incredibly capable. So the fact that he was inside that plant gate, Sibel, whether he was head of security or just a guard, is very significant.
Well, Peter Lance, I want to thank you for joining us today. And again, I want to direct people to your website. It's chock full of information. That's peterlance.com. And I know you've been delayed on publishing your next book, but are you back on track? And do you have any word on when to expect that?
I'm back on track. I'm working on it every day, and I should have word soon. But it's called 666. If you get Triple Cross, you'll see there's an advertisement for it at the very last page of the book, and it has to do with this DeVecchio Scarpa scandal that is part of the information I have in this Playboy article, The Chilling Effect, wherein this treasure trove of Al-Qaeda-related evidence was effectively buried by Fitzgerald and other senior Justice Department officials in 1996. Called it a hoax and a scam. It's extraordinary evidence. And on peterlance.com, if you scroll down on the homepage, below Dan Rather's picture on the left, you'll see Scarpa 302s, and you'll see a number of these FBI 302 memos. I have two inches thick of them. For 11 months, the FBI operated a sting operation in New York, in which they had a mob figure in the jail cell, in between Ramzi Youssef and Abdul-Hakim Murad, the original Atah, the original lead pilot of the 9/11 plot. And this guy is stinging on behalf of the FBI Youssef, getting a treasure trove of evidence that the FBI later discredits. And one of the principal discreditors is Patrick Fitzgerald. He signed a sworn affirmation that's published in my book as an appendix on June 25th, 99, and he, under penalty of perjury, discredits this evidence, claiming it's a hoax and a scam. The evidence is self-authenticating. It's absolutely true and real. Youssef had no reason for fabricating. He's on trial for his life. Scott had a 10th grade education. You'll see that there are bomb schematics that could only have been known to Youssef. Youssef also, in the course of this material, talks about killing three separate federal officials. That would have been made him subject to further prosecution. No way did Youssef scam the feds on this. This was, for reasons that I get into a little bit in the article on Playboy, and more deeply in Triple Cross, this was an ends-means decision the Justice Department made. And Patrick Fitzgerald went along with it. So, therefore, if Patrick Fitzgerald knew, I want to underscore this, if Patrick Fitzgerald knew that evidence was genuine, and he should have known it, given his intelligence and his role, then his calling it a hoax and a scam on a sworn affirmation could have subjected him to the same charges he convicted Scooter Libby on. Perjury and obstruction of justice. So you might get some sense, again, of why Patrick Fitzgerald wanted to pulp Triple Cross.
Peter Lance, fabulous talking with you. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Great. Thank you.
Thank
and
you,
thanks,
Peter.
Sibel, for all the great work you do.
Good to have you.
You
water. Take the only tree that's left. Stuff it up the hole in your culture. Give me a bank or a burning wall. Give me a star and a thing all. I've seen the future, brother. It is murder.
Leo Cohen and the future. The future. Well, that depends on us. Thank you for joining us. We'll be back soon with more Boiling Frogs interviews.